online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Concerns from fishers as aquaculture giant Tassal buys up big in Western Australia's Kimberley region.
If they're going to want sustainable aquaculture, then everyone has to be on the same page. And I think monitoring is a big thing. I think being up here and so far away, I would have thought, you know, maybe that might get a little bit lackluster.
And what would you pay for the best steak in Australia?
You would be lucky to get that piece of steak in Australia. If you could, you know, probably around $200 a kilo is what it would be worth.
Good afternoon, I'm Fiona Breen. We'll have more on that story shortly. But first, we're going to look at the supermarket inquiry again. And in recent days, the inquiry has switched to Bunnings suppliers. And they're suppliers of garden plants to Australia's biggest hardware chain. They've told the Senate inquiry they were treated so badly by Bunnings that the resulting stress on some of those nursery owners threatened marriages and left some feeling like slaves. Bunnings, which is owned by ASX-listed conglomerate Wesfarmers, has denied the accusations and is urging its suppliers to go directly to the company to report concerns. It'll also get its chance to speak at the Senate inquiry this afternoon. One of the suppliers who flew to Canberra to speak at the inquiry was Karen Brock, a grower and nursery owner from Winkley in the north of Tasmania. Good afternoon, Karen. Thanks for joining the Country Hour.
Thank you, Fiona, for the invitation.
Now, that would have been a big deal for you, getting the courage and actually flying over to Canberra to speak before the politicians in the Senate inquiry?
It certainly was. And the gentleman that accompanied me that I'd never met before, he was equally feeling a bit stressed. We were originally, it wasn't even a question for us because we were not Bunnings suppliers
anymore.
At this stage anymore. And the industry happened to be talking to us because they had been receiving numerous big burly men having, you know, quite emotional interviews with them and about the situation that they found themselves in. And then right at the end of the conversation, they'd say to our CEO, "I'm sorry, but you can't use our names because we'll be targeted."
I suppose these are sorts of things we heard about from farmers at the supermarket inquiry, whether they'd be growing, you know, all sorts of vegetables or fruit. Some of them didn't feel like they could speak. Well, let's talk about some of your experiences, because you obviously had a really challenging time, and you actually said it was so stressful it put pressure on your marriage.
It did. We were, my husband in particular, we was working for like 4:30 in the morning till 11 o'clock at night, 7 days a week, years on end. We didn't have a holiday for 12 years.
But why is that? Why was it so hard? I mean, you made a choice to supply Bunnings, but
did you
make money? You obviously kept going.
Well, it's a bit of a trick because you start off, everything's going really well, like any new marriage or relationship. And as the years go on, people change. And there was a really distinct cultural change around 2010 to 2012, in that time frame, where suddenly partnerships or working with you was not a keen focus. Now, unfortunately, by this stage, based on your previous experience, and yes, we were making some money at that stage. It wasn't a lot, but we had enough to hire, you know, 2 to 3 people to assist us. And then suddenly we were moving to robotic assistance because we couldn't get our prices up, but our cost of goods was going up and our infrastructure cost was rising. And then it got to the point where you're made to feel poorly because you don't dare ask for a price increase because we have to look after our customers. And we've got to keep the price low to make sure that the customers are getting the best product. And we're going to sell lots of your plants by doing this.
So over 13 years you were a supplier, how many price increases did they give you?
One.
Over 13 years. So in the end...
And that was in 2008.
Right. So were you selling plants at a loss?
We were actually looking at lean process management to the point where we were so lean that it was just the two of us and a robot who was doing all the plants. The trouble is you get to a point where we actually were just churning over money to pay for the bank loan for the robot, the bank loan for the greenhouses, your mortgage. So you were literally paying off your infrastructure to serve them, but you actually weren't paying yourself.
And in terms of, you know, knowing what you were going to produce, because at one point I think you had 26% of the available store space for plants in the Tasmanian Bunnings, was that sort of the same from year to year?
It was incrementally growing at that stage up until about 2014. And again, remember I said about the time of change. We were visual merchandising. So basically, very similar to a supermarket, they say, we want your product on this space here. And it is up to you to make sure that that space is chock-a-block full at all times. And it had to be literally 12 months of the year. You had to make sure that you had stock on those shelves. They were carefully monitoring how your stock turned over. So our stock would, you know, in some of our ranges would sit on the shelf for maybe 2 weeks. Other stocks would sit there for 4 weeks. And if it went up to 6 weeks, they'd say, well, you're obviously not presenting the stock well enough, or you had to keep it fresh. So we would have to take back anything that didn't sell that would be credited against our account.
Did you have to take back
something was fresh?
Did you have to take back many?
In some cases, we did. Like, it just depended on whether they'd suddenly bought a special in, and suddenly you've got competition and your product doesn't sell, so therefore you have to credit that back and go and replenish it at your own expense.
Karen Brock, you told the inquiry, and you listed this in your submission about growing water lilies in particular. Can you give us just a brief outline of what you told the inquiry there?
So I didn't get the opportunity. I've just literally put it in a submission. It was basically for 3 years that we want you to grow water lilies. We want you to grow water lilies. At that stage, Tasmania only had Kings Meadows store. They had Moona and they had Rosny, what I call a couple of sort of like, well, one was a postcard, one size of a postcard. And we said no. And then Bernie was coming on board, and again, you get this promise of, we're bringing on Bernie, and then we've got North Launceston closely following, then we've got Glenorchy, and by the way, we've just kinched Kingston as well. So we decided, okay, let's go with the flow and invest in the War Lily project. It was a $10,000 investment. By the time you buy the plants, you set up a very big water system. And even the week before Bunnings opened in Burnie, we could not get a barcode to suddenly sell the water lilies that we've produced for them because, oh, no, I want a 200ml pot, not a 140ml pot. Why the heck didn't you say that beforehand? And then we finally get a barcode because she sees the product and it's like, wow, this is fabulous. Can I show the stores? Photographs were taken by Bunnings. Yes, sure, no problem. Those photographs were used to harangue another grower in Victoria who'd been growing them for a number of years. If this person can do it in 1 year and they look this fabulous, why don't yours look this fabulous?
Right.
And I was just like, that's my IP, and I lodged a complaint.
And did you sell those lilies in the end?
We sold through so many lilies that when we purchased our initial stock, we initially thought we'll have some left over for divisions for the subsequent years. We literally sold out. And so I had also had the Nuffield experience, and I'd started getting we need numbers. We need to know what we're doing. We're putting a lot of investment into stock on the ground, and we need to know the numbers. And they came back with 96 water lilies for their future orders.
Right. And is that what happened?
We go with 96 water lilies, plus they also brought on a second grower in the state to act as our competitor. And we said, we're not in those games. We're not going to go down that track. We're not going to invest in a backup of stock to supply your stores. And it got so hilarious that they even at the end, when they had no water lease, started sending me an email saying, we want you to dig up someone's dam and put the water lease in a pot and put them in our stores. It was just ridiculous.
Okay, Karen Brock, now your submission says there was a lot of pressure in your marriage. You decided to opt out of the relationship with Bunnings, pretty much start again.
We did. Coming back from the Nuffield experience made me realise that, unlike a lot of growers, we were in a really good place financially, in that everything had been paid off, all the vehicles, all the robots, all the greenhouses. All we had was our mortgage at that stage. And I said to my husband, they're going to keep growing. You're going to keep running around this hamster wheel, and you literally cannot get off. And as I said in my submission, you cannot please these people. No matter what you do, you cannot please them. And the minute that there is any minor imperfection or complaint, they make sure that, you know, surreptitiously you are targeted as to suddenly have your price at the retail point put up, so your sales slow down. Oh, those plants aren't so popular anymore. We don't want you to supply those. All that sort of what I call, they're bullying mechanisms, actually.
They're
surreptitious bullying mechanisms.
A lot of pressure by the sounds of it. You've had your turn of speaking at the inquiry into supermarket prices. This sounds like there are a couple of other people. We've got the companies on this afternoon, so we'll hear from them as well. Karen Brock, thanks so much for joining the Country Hour.
Thank you so much. And it's absolutely wonderful that the whole industry is right behind our CEO on this one.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Karen Brock. And Bunnings will speak at the Senate inquiry this afternoon. But so far it's denied any of the accusation and is urging suppliers to go directly to the company to report concerns.
Coffee for Tony Armstrong. Extra hot almond latte, light on the froth.
Yep. Thanks, mate. Okay, so I like my coffee my way, just how I like my news. If you want to stay in the know your way, it's pretty easy. With the ABC News app or by heading straight to the ABC News website. Or if having emails in your inbox is the go, hit us up for newsletters. It's news your way. All the latest, all verified, all the time. That's a good coffee. Stay in the know with ABC News.
It's the Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Tassau is best known for farming salmon in Tasmania, but it's moved into prawns in New South Wales and North Queensland and has now bought up big in Western Australia's Kimberley region. The internationally owned salmon giant has acquired a barramundi farm on the shores of some of WA's most remote and rugged coastline. It has options to expand, but as Elise Marshall found out, some locals are uneasy at that prospect.
Anchors down in the Buccaneer Archipelago. Wayne Foley has fished these waters for decades.
Okay, I don't know which way we're going to float here, but we'll soon find out.
It's one of Australia's most remote coastlines, situated in northern WA, characterised by its rugged islands that dot bright aquamarine water. As a Derby local, Wayne calls this region home, and he never thought he'd see global seafood giant Tassal on his doorstep.
who would expect to run into that, like, in this place? Like, we're miles from everywhere.
Canadian-owned Tassal last year announced its acquisition of Marine Produce Australia, the company behind Cone Bay Barramundi. Sitting in the middle of the Kimberley Aquaculture Development Zone, Tassal will be moving into WA waters that have been marked as investment-ready, with environmental checks and management policies already in place. It means commercial aquaculture operations can set up quickly, without going through lengthy approvals processes. But this doesn't reassure Wayne Foley.
You know, with the experience of the marine park and some government agencies, like, a lot doesn't get said, and you need to physically go in and find it on the internet like I have been doing. Like, it's really hard to be informed. My understanding, they need to sharpen up their rules. I think the EPA needs to sharpen up their rules as well. If they're going to want sustainable aquaculture, then everyone has to be on the same page. And I think monitoring is a big thing. I think being up here and so far away, I would have thought, you know, maybe that might get a little bit lacklustre.
He's done his own research into Tassal's history. In 2017, the island state's environmental watchdog ordered Tassal to destock one of its farming leases that neighbours the World Heritage Area in Macquarie Harbour. The order followed an EPA report showing conditions in the harbour had worsened, with increased levels of bacteria and low levels of oxygen surrounding the Tassal ponds.
They don't have a very good reputation, and we don't want to see any of pollution or anything like that, you know, escaping fish, which has happened in Cone Bay in recent. So we don't want to see any of that.
The Kimberley coastline, however, does boast very different features to that of Tasmania. Most notable are the tides, which at Cone Bay regularly reach 11 metres in height and can wash more fish waste out to sea than those in Tasmania. Tom Middleton is Tassal's General Manager for Corporate Affairs. He wants to reassure Derby locals.
We understand just how passionate people in the Kimberley are about the local environment and particularly the marine environment. We certainly, you know, have a long history of working closely with government and the regulators and working with the scientific community about ensuring that that the local marine environment is appropriately managed. At the top level, Tassal has a lot of experience and is really eager to share that with our Barramundi operations and make sure that we can continue to sustainably manage the environment in which we work.
In recent years, the company's operations have only grown as they've moved into prawn farming in Queensland and New South Wales, and now, for the first time, into WA Barramundi.
We've now rebranded the organisation from a product perspective so that not just salmon will have both the prawns and the Barramundi to come under the Tassal banner at the moment. That's out in retailers at the moment. We're looking forward to leverage our great relationships with those retailers to grow the Barramundi brand and name out in stores. We think that it's a really fantastic, delicious, nutritious product for Australians. We think it's going to be one they're going to love.
The previous owners of Cone Bay Barramundi had already submitted plans to extend their Kimberley fish farm by more than tenfold, citing the operation's lack of commercial viability at its current size. Tassal wouldn't confirm whether it planned to keep with these previous expansion plans.
There's been some pretty bold promises in aquaculture in the Kimberley over a long time. We want to try and make sure that we have a clear position that we can communicate with regulators, with the community, with traditional owners who all have such an important role to play in the Kimberley. So we're firming up the position as it is at the moment.
The ABC reached out a number of times to the Myala in Inalang Aboriginal Corporation and the Kimberley Land Council, who represent the traditional owners of the Buccaneer Archipelago. They declined to comment on this story. Peter George is part of the Tasmanian anti-salmon farming group Neighbours of Fish Farming. A long-time campaigner against Tassal salmon farms, he's opposed to them due to what he sees as an inherent lack of transparency within the company.
The last thing you want is to have Tassal in your neighbourhood, as we have learned. They take no notice of the issues that the community raises. They become a large industry distributing pollution into beautiful waterways. And you can, it's like banging your head against a brick wall. One of the greatest problems with TASAL and with the industry generally has been that they do not communicate with the local people.
But TASAL's Tom Middleton pushes back on that notion.
All I can say is that we work very closely with the communities we operate in our salmon and prawn farming operations. We have so many passionate advocates from those local communities. We invest very heavily in those community groups with local schools and sporting clubs and environmental projects. We're determined to do that in the Kimberley, in those areas with which you operate and with those traditional owner groups. We also look forward to building relationships with local suppliers and, where possible, investing in those local communities so that they know when we're doing well, they'll be supported as well.
But in a place like Derby, where locals have seen big businesses wash in and out like the tide, there's a wariness surrounding those that make bold claims.
You know, I think they have the money and the power to push it through, and they also can promise a lot, which if they do, let's hope it comes true, but if they don't, like any other overseas company, I think there could be a problem there.
And that story aired on Landline yesterday. You can catch up on ABC iView. Now, a two-year-old Wagyu heifer has topped this year's elite Wagyu sales, selling for $130,000. Bred by Mayura Station in South Australia, the sale capped off a big week for that property, which also crowned to have the best Wagyu steak in the country. Mac McDonough is the CEO of the Australian Wagyu Association. He spoke to Matt Brann about what made Mayura's heifer so special.
It was the balance of breeding. So we've come from a position where we've had some genetics exported out of Japan 30 years ago. That were genetics from around 200 individuals. And at that time, they picked a range of unique individuals that were good for different traits, and it really took Australia probably 20 years just to amplify up the number of animals in the population here. And it's only the last 10 years we've really started to bring the optimal trait combinations together using genetics and the genomics tools that the AWA provides to its members to combine all of those best traits into one animal. And you're seeing that now with some of these elite genetics offerings like that heifer. You know, she's just supreme for several of the core traits that the Wagyu industry is looking to advance. And if we can move all of those traits forward together in an animal like that, she's worth a lot of money.
And she was bought by the Thomas family, who run a Wagyu operation in the United States. Now, how big of a deal is it for an overseas buyer to get involved?
It's not unusual. Certainly the last four or five conferences we've had, you know, at least 10% of the attendees at the conference are internationals. So we have people all over the world coming into the conference here, and this year it's in Cairns. You know, with 650 delegates coming in to learn all about the Australian production industry, and part of that is, you know, accessing, you know, the expertise that sits in the room here, and there's an enormous amount of networking going on, and the ability to get stuck in and buy some of our leading genetics at the Elite Wagyu Sale. And, you know, 90% of the lots that are sold go, you know, stay in Australia. About 10% are probably sold internationally. You know, we had 100 bidders online last night from around the world trying to get stuck in, but they get out-competed,
yeah,
mostly. And look, the opportunity is there to buy an animal like that heifer, get her into a reproduction centre into Australia, and, you know, get some extremely high genetic merit embryos and genetic material to export back to the home country.
Right, so that's really her destiny, is it? She won't be flown back to the US?
No, no, she'll go into a centre somewhere in Australia.
Right.
And, yeah, they'll use her to get some embryos out of her and export those to the US. So the sale to the Thomases at Santos Patronos is not unusual and really, really welcome.
It's been a big week for Mayura Station. It was also crowned Grand Champion in the Wagyu branded beef competition. Can you tell us a bit about this class one steak of its?
Firstly, I'll just congratulate Scott De Bruin and the team at Mayura Station. They're obviously having an absolute banger of a week. They're hitting it out of the park, winning the branded beef competition and having the highest sale lot in the elite Wagyu sale. So Scott's having an absolutely fantastic week, and I'm sure he's celebrated well. But that piece of meat, it had two things which were really unique to it. The first thing, and so it was a full blood entry, that's not unique. We had about 15 full blood entries. This entry was the largest ever eye muscle that we'd seen in a steak that had been, in a piece of meat that had been submitted to the Wagyu brand of beef competition. And it was 62% unsaturated fat. So the fat in that piece of steak was about 60% IMF anyway. So extremely high amount of fine marbling in a very large ribeye. And the marbling in the ribeye was over 60% unsaturated fat. So when you cook that piece of meat and eat it, it's literally dissolving in your mouth. The temperature of the mouth is more than the fat needs to become liquid and dissolve. So you get an extremely juicy, rich experience, extremely tender. It's almost like the meat's bursting in your mouth when you eat it. It's an incredible experience. And that piece of meat was just unique. We'd seen nothing like it before.
And that was Matt McDonough. He's the CEO of the Australian Wagyu Association. Time for the news headlines now with Liz Gwynn.
Good afternoon, Faye. Victorian Government Minister Colin Brooks says men's attitudes towards women need to change in the wake of the deadly Bondi Junction rampage. The New South Wales Police Commissioner has said that it's obvious the attacker focused on women during his rampage. Mr. Brooks says everyone has to have a conversation about men's attitudes towards women, including parents and teachers. Bakeries in northern Gaza have reopened with Palestinians waiting in queues to buy much-needed bread. The shops were forced to close months ago due to a lack of flour. Most Israeli troops have been pulled out of Gaza in preparation for an assault on its southernmost city, Rafah, but fighting has continued in various areas. The UN says millions of people in Gaza are on the brink of famine. And in sport, Jack Jumpers supporters are encouraged to be part of history by etching their name on a championship wall at each of the club's home venues in Launceston and Hobart. The team will also be creating a virtual wall online so people can be recognised no matter where they're based. I'll have more news at one.
Thank you, Liz. Time to cross to the Weather Bureau now. Good afternoon, Matthew Thomas.
Hi, Fiona. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Now, have we had much rainfall overnight?
Look, the rainfall that we've had to 9 a.m. was mostly concentrated about the west of the state with generally 5 to 15 millimetres. Lake Margaret, as usual, picked up a little bit more, 23 millimetres. Now, elsewhere in the more agricultural areas, we did see some showers about the northwest, the Huon and parts of the Upper Derwent Valley, but those rainfall totals were generally 0 to 2 millimetres for those locations. And since 9 a.m, most of the rainfall has been about the west with a further 1 to 5 millimetres.
What about the outlook now?
Now, we've got a cold front that's approaching from the southwest, and that's going to brush the west and the south of the state today before weakening to a trough and running up the east coast and just lingering over the subsequent couple of days about the northeast of the state. But for the remainder of today, we will see that shower activity just sort of increase about the west and far south and just remain about the Bass Strait Islands. But we'll see some light afternoon showers extending to, mostly southern and central parts of the state. Slight chance we could see some also about the north east of the state around sort of Scottsdale. But in terms of amounts, we're looking at the bulk of the rainfall being about the west and generally 0 to 2 millimetres in any rainfall that will fall over any agricultural areas today. And then into tomorrow, a high-pressure system moving over the Bight will extend a ridge across southern Tasmania. And that will see shower activity really confined mostly to the west. But that trough just lingering about the northeast will see some showers developing about the upper east coast during the day, and we will see in terms of shower activity around 2 to 10 millimetres about the west of the state, but north to 5 millimetres about the northeast. Now it will mostly be about the ranges or coastal, and mostly the coastal part will be the upper east coast around St Helens. Into Wednesday, that high over the Bight will remain, and with the trough just weakening about the northeast, and we will see some shower activity about the west of the state and also about the northeast, the amounts will decrease, and we're only really looking at about 0 to 2 millimetres, with the showers about the northeast being a little bit more extensive and just taking in all of the northeast, the upper east coast, as well as the Furneaux Islands. Into Thursday, another cold front to cross the state. Once again, showers mostly about the west of the state. We will see some lighter showers and look less than 2 millimetres, but most locations, particularly the central north and the far northeast, are unlikely to pick up anything out of it. Just sort of those light showers just extending to other parts in the afternoon for a period as that front does cross. And then into Friday, shower activity really dropping off as the high moves from the Bight to just northwest of King Island, extending a ridge over Tasmania, and we'll see some really light showers about the southwest and far south. So, look, generally below average rainfall continuing for most locations, and what rainfall there will be fairly small amounts.
Any warnings at all?
We do have strong wind warnings current for southern coastal waters from Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point for today. No warnings for tomorrow.
What about coastal waters and swell?
For the remainder of today, we've currently got west to northwesterly winds of 15 to 25 knots, although reaching 30 knots about the south, although the winds are lighter and more variable about the east. But the winds will tend west to southwesterly at 10 to 20 knots during the evening about most waters apart from the south, although more southerly at 10 to 15 knots about the east coast. Into Tuesday, we'll have west to southwesterly winds of 10 to 20 knots, although 15 to 25 knots about the south, and the winds variable at 5 to 15 knots about the upper east coast, and also from the afternoon about the west coast as that ridge begins to extend across the south of the state. With the swells around the west and the south, a southwesterly swell of 3 to 4 metres, but building to 4 to 5 metres after the front does cross this evening, and then maintaining that through much of tomorrow before slightly decaying to 3.5 to 4.5 metres tomorrow evening. About the north, a westerly generally below 1 metre. About the east, a southerly of 0.5 to 1.5 metres, but building up to 2 metres during the evening as that southerly push pushes up the east coast, and tending more southwesterly up to 3 metres offshore in the south. The wave rider buoy at Cape Sorel currently has a significant wave of 4.1 metres, a maximum wave of 6.4 metres, and a 13-second period.
All right, Matthew Thomas, thanks very much.
No worries. Bye.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour. You're with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, we have insurance populations for all sorts of things, from grains in the Arctic Circle to raising endangered animals on islands. And now there are plans underway to preserve the genetic heritage of the state's rarest apples and pears. Larissa Smith spoke to AgriGrowth's Assistant Director, Carolyn Brown, about the project.
A lot of people would be aware of the Grove Heritage Orchard. The department has been operating that, or has owned that property since 1951. And the collection comprises around 660 odd varieties of apple rootstocks, pear, quince, and crab apples, essentially pome fruits. And that has been sitting there, and over a lot of time growers and breeders have been accessing that collection to look at their own research and obtain those varieties to grow in their own orchards. And since 2012, there was some work undertaken by Dr. Gordon Brown at the time, which looked at the different varieties that were in that collection. The collection has been in care and maintenance by the department, and we've been looking at, well, what is the importance of this collection in the breadth of cultivars that we have, and are they in other orchards throughout Australia? So we're really trying to narrow down what are the really critical cultivars that are based at Grove and nowhere else. And this is what the insurance population project is about, really understanding, well, what are those critical ones that we really need to focus on to make sure that we're not losing that genetic diversity if, for example, we had an unfortunate situation like a bushfire.
How do you determine the significance of a cultivar that it's so unique or even globally significant?
Some of the ones that we've identified that aren't anywhere else, for example, are an apple variety called Chardin, which is a golden delicious cross. It was a apple variety that was developed in France back in the 1950s. That doesn't appear to be in any other collection. So one of the reasons that we've reached out to people that might be listening today or others is to learn, well, are there other places where it may be being grown that we're not aware of? That, you know, we'd be interested in finding more out about. The interesting thing with a lot of the varieties that have been produced in modern times is that they are, you can narrow those down predominantly to six varieties that have been hybridised since around the 1920s, and one of those is the Golden Delicious. So if we're looking at the opportunities that in the future around maintaining apple collections, apple diversity because of the changing climate and managing diseases and pests and pathogens into the future, making sure that we've got collections like this can be really important. So another variety, for example, that people would be aware of would be Gravenstein, which is an apple that originated back in the 1600s, back in Denmark, that is a variety that doesn't genetically come from those six more common parents, for want of a better term, like your Golden Delicious. And so maintaining those types of varieties and cultivars is really important in these types of collections.
Would you think about putting this new insurance population, say, at the other end of the state in the northwest?
We certainly haven't narrowed down yet where the population could be. We have had some discussions, for example, with the Royal Botanical Gardens in Hobart and Government House, but we haven't ruled in or ruled out any location. For us, it's about looking at the suitability, looking at how we can manage that insurance population, but more importantly, you know, somewhere like Government House can be an attraction to, well, isn't it already an attraction to the public, and being able to highlight to people the importance of planting their own trees and maintaining that diversity by growing apples and engaging the public in the importance of maintaining that genetic diversity and them being able to see and even taste these fruits that they may not have experienced is an important opportunity. As I said, we haven't ruled in or ruled out any particular location at this point in time as we're progressing on with the project.
Assistant Director of AgriGrowth, Carolyn Brown. Time for a bit of music. I will follow by you too. And we've got a couple of texts that have come in today. Aaron from Swansea loves eating Wagyu. Well, you're lucky. You've tried it. I have actually tried it on a barbecue when out in a job for the ABC. Had a little taste and it definitely does melt in the mouth. It's quite different. And we've got another text from David. Don't forget the best apple ever, Cox's Orange Pippin. That's David talking about those heritage apples that Agri Futures is trying to save. Now, when you're new to a town, it can be difficult to make connections and settle in, especially if English isn't your first language. Hazara Afghan man Haja Alzaida says fruit picking can help. He's helped around 100 new arrivals to Tasmania with migrant and refugee backgrounds find work in the field.
Australia, we are a nation of people from, you know, so many different walk of lives and experience, and you see people with, you know, so much different capacities. You know, if you have people, I remember, it was very interesting. One day, I remember one of the elderly ladies, I think she would be about 60 years of age, and picking fruit, still picking fruit, and then asking, and then there was another fella. He was a lagger, basically. He was about, you know, 18 or 20 or 19 years old. He born here in Australia, grew up here. And then kept asking me that, you know, when we're going to knock off. He was saying that he was tired. And then at the same time, I'm seeing this elderly lady that, oh, don't call, you know, knock off early today. I want to keep going. Can I leave us? You know, leave us another hour. I want to keep working. And then at that moment, you see this. You know, these people are like, wow, look at this person. You know, who are at the age of 60 and wants to keep going. And then you see this young fella. You know, his job is much easier than her.
That tells a story about the different backgrounds that people have come from and the expectations and the hardships as well.
Oh, definitely, yes. I think, you know, it would be wrong of us to judge them and, you know, kind of misinterpret their, you know, and also ignore their abilities and their hard-working, basically, capacities. I think we got to keep, you know, take that into account. That's very important. And I think this is the people that do the hard works on the ground here in the country, and we've had, you know, in the history of the country, we've seen that immigrants have played a very important role, you know, in doing all those difficult and hard, basically, roles.
So talking about, yeah, the role of fruit picking again, what about the skills? What crucial skills do migrants and refugees learn when they're out in the field?
Definitely, yes. There would be a chance for them to practice their language, definitely. And also basically build a network as well at the same time as they're building their skills, and also build their knowledge of people of different race, ethnicity and walk of life, basically. I think it's very, very interesting seeing them building all those communication channels, you know, with each other, and then again staying in contact and, you know, and helping each other. I think fruit picking fruit picking gave them basically a chance. For some of them, it was the first time working here in Australia to see basically the work in Australia and what sort of, let's say, expectations out there are from employers, you know, from employees.
What are the differences in terms of how employment works, say, in a country like Afghanistan? How would you describe the differences with the employer?
I mean, there are differences, yes. You know, when you compare a country like Australia to Afghanistan in terms of the relationship, in terms of, you know, basically the way they would work and interact, basically. Let's say, you know, back in Afghanistan, it wouldn't, you know, here in Australia, we, especially with the fruit picking, you know, they will get paid per hour. You know, there's a minimum wage, basically, in place. And also, they will get paid, you know, per lakh or per box when they work. But a country like, you know, like Afghanistan, it would be, they will get paid per day. You know, the whole day, they have to work about, you know, 10 hours of a shift. And also, basically, the work, you know, environment would be, especially under the current Afghan government, Afghan, you know, the Taliban regime, which that, you know, would be a completely different work environment. Let's say, you know, you wouldn't see any women, any female at work, at this sort of work, you know, back in Afghanistan at the moment, which is very sad. But in Australia, you know, we see people of different, you know, genders, different ages, you know, ethnic groups and so on, working all together and happily together working. But, you know, when you compare it with Afghanistan, you know, you won't see any, especially at this age, at the moment, any females working, especially this kind of work, you know, where it's related, you know, men and women working together. So it's a massive difference, of course.
Haji Alizada talking to Madeline Rojan about his work with Afghan migrants and refugees in horticulture. Now, for thousands of years, Aboriginal nation groups journeyed to Queensland's Bunya Mountains and Black Hall Range, gathering when large nutfield cones weighing up to 10 kilograms dropped from bunya trees. But the trees are under attack from dieback, which has spread from the Bunya Mountains to the Black Hall Range. Jennifer Nichols takes up the story.
Nature lovers have long admired a magnificent stand of bunya pines on Landsborough-Mullaney Road, a popular scenic route in the Sunshine Coast hinterland. Now, most of the trees here are leafless and lifeless, sobering evidence that bunya dieback is spreading.
I was first at this site about a year ago, and there probably were about 5 out of the 11 trees that were dead, and now most of them are dead.
A senior forest pathologist with the Queensland Department of Agriculture and Fisheries, Dr. Louise Shuey, has been researching dieback in the Bunya Mountains.
It's quite heartbreaking, really.
The ancient species Araucaria bidwillii once fed dinosaurs with its spiky, football-sized cones, and has survived since the Jurassic period, dating back at least 145 million years. But in recent times, bunya pines have been under attack from microscopic invaders called Phytophthora that have been introduced since European settlement.
It's a fungal-like organism. It's not a fungus, but it's microscopic water mold that's pathogenic and lives in the soil. Amazing that something so small can take down 800-year-old trees. The way it does it is it infects through the fine feeder roots.
Dr. Louise Shuey says tests have shown that the dead stand of bunyas in Mullaney was infected by a different type of dieback than Phytophthora multivora, which has been killing both bunya and hoop pines in the Bunya Mountains.
We've detected Phytophthora cinnamomei underneath, not Phytophthora multivora. Cinnamomei tends to move more like a bulldozer through, so you don't get that patchy dieback as much. All of the trees here are dead, rather than just being patchy like it is at the Bunya Mountains.
To collaborate in the search for solutions, Bunya People's Aboriginal Corporation members travelled to Mullaney for the Beyond Bunya Dieback Symposium.
We have been calling them skeletons. The bunya trees, once they've fully gone through the infection process, they've just left a skeleton behind, so they've dropped all their limbs and leaves, as well as just a bunch of canopy missing from the rainforest, which is really sad to see.
Walking in the footsteps of his ancestors who treasured the majestic trees, Adrian Bowen says he's been mapping dieback deaths in the section of the Bunya Mountains National Park he cares for.
And how many have you been spotting?
If I gave you a figure, it'd probably make you sad. It's everywhere.
Dr. Louise Shuey says any activity that moves soil, water or plant material can spread Phytophthora, including bushwalking, mountain biking, four-wheel driving, timber harvesting and feral pig incursions.
People do a really good job of moving Phytophthora around, so getting that message out to come clean, go clean when you bushwalk, walking through a state forest, mountain biking through a state forest. Make sure your gear's clean, your shoes are clean, your bike's clean. Don't go out when it's muddy.
Adrian Bowen says ignorance is no excuse, and prominent cleaning stations have been installed in the Bunya Mountains National Park.
Unfortunately, we have had people just ignore the problem. When it gets wet, that's when the dieback's spreading. So we go and close some of our tracks to stop that spread. However, we've found tracks around our washdown station, so people are just seeing the sign on, whatever, I came out to bunyas, I'm going to enjoy it. So they'll go on the tracks anyway and spread it. And because they're not using the washdown, it's just going everywhere. It's not being managed, really. I always imagine myself walking with my old people, so, you know, I have an obligation to them to help protect this. So it really is disheartening.
Spencer and Karen Shaw from Brush Turkey Enterprises and Forest Heart Nursery organised Queensland's first dieback symposium, bringing together around 100 people, including community members and representatives from councils, national parks, land care and conservation organisations.
That's actually what I've been really excited about. So there's a whole group of people from all these different stakeholder groups are all concerned and have come together to share knowledge, to learn knowledge, and hopefully together have some kind of action for the future.
And that was all about the bunya trees around the Sunshine Coast. And that was Dr. Louise Shuey, a senior forest pathologist with the Queensland Department of Agriculture and Fisheries. And good afternoon, Joel Reinberger.
Hello there, Fiona. Now, we're being warned today by a press release that people basically have too much junk in their sheds and it's a fire risk. It's becoming a fire hazard for people. You know, the shed will just go up, particularly if you're one of those people who collects timber for their shed. So I'm asking people today, what is the most ridiculous item they have in their shed, the most ridiculous piece of junk in their shed, the thing that should have been chucked out 10, 20 years ago. So my producer, Lucy, they have the door to a Hyundai Sonata, which they haven't owned that car for 10 years. They bought the door to pull out the window mechanism at a junkyard, and they've kept the door. And it's still there, and they haven't got rid of it. And when I painted the house, and I went and looked amongst my paint cans for what was the colour we painted this house 10 years ago, there's the paint cans from the previous paint job, from the previous owners 20 years ago.
We would have
snot green, I'll tell you. Snot green, beautiful.
Charming. Charming. Well, we have a lot of timber. My husband is a bit of a hoarder, so nothing gets thrown out. I put stuff in the junk pile and it goes in the shed. The whole family goes round, on those days when there's stuff outside.
Oh, the hard rubbish
day. The hard rubbish, and we end up with a couch or something like that that goes on a veranda.
One day I'll fix this table. No, you won't.
Yes,
let's just chop it up and put it in the fireplace. That's what you should be doing with these things. So we're chasing that down today. What is the most ridiculous piece of junk in your shed?
Thank you, Joel Reinberger, and I'll catch up with you tomorrow on The Country Hour at noon.
The radio station I listen to the most.
ABC Radio Hobart.
936 AM.
ABC Radio Hobart.
Now we're talking.